Welcome, everyone, to the First Name Basis podcast. I'm your host, Sheetal Jaitley. This is where we chat with industry leaders and innovators and make things really real and authentic. With me today, I got Nihal Mehta, who is a good friend of mine, an investor in Tribal Skill, an investor in many things, and we're going to get into that. But Nihal, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Sheetal. You mentioned industry leaders, so I'm definitely in the wrong podcast. But thanks for having me. As a filler, I appreciate that.
Dude, what does your company call you? I just got an email or a message the other day. They call you the human Rolodex?
Yeah, most people are like, what is a Rolodex? What is it? don't know. Millennials don't know what
they
Rolodex
don't know. Is. Yeah. They don't know. So look, I put an inspirational background on for you, man. I got Marquee, I think it's Las Vegas, happening behind me. In better times, we'll head back there.
Yeah. It's open, apparently.
I'm sure. It's just raging.
I think Dennis Rodman might be there.
Is that Purell that's squirting out of the top? It's the Purell confetti. dude, welcome. I wanted to kick it off and talk a little bit about your journey. I'm fortunate enough to know a lot of the people who come on this podcast, but everybody's got a pretty cool story, a tough story that they've gone through. And I'd love to hear yours is really cool, funny along the way as well, but a lot of hard work and dedication took to get you where you're at right now. So give us a little bit of background about yourself.
Yeah, I. By the way, my beard is not usually this long, so this is the quarantine.
Me too.
This is probably the height of the beard girth.
I got my mullet happening too.
Oh yeah, yeah, I've got that too. Which is actually, it's reassuring as an old man to like actually be growing hair back there, which is nice. And then also, I was surprised that the beard wasn't as gray as I anticipated. But anyway. This is probably max girth. Girth's a good Scrabble word, by the way, for those of you that play Scrabble, G-I-R-T-H. I don't know how many points it is, but it's a good word. I started my career as a DJ and promoter. What they say, once a promoter, always a promoter, probably. In college and even after, you would find me on street corners kind of handing out flyers, to the next big party. And in college, my roommate and I were DJs, and we decided, instead of kind of telling folks where we were playing and what was going on, that we just build a website. The year was 1999, and you scribble .com on a napkin and you were famous. We came close to going public, not really, but we ended up cobbling together, $1 million from aunties and uncles, all over the world. We had billboards on 95 and commercials on MTV, produced by The Roots, by the way.
Awesome.
Actually, we had Scratch doing a beatbox for PhillyTonight.com. I still have the audio. It's pretty epic. But, we spent that $1 million pretty quick. We were 21, 22 years old.
Sure.
And that was kind of our first stint at running a startup. And sure enough, 2001 hit hard. 9/11 hit hard as well. And the economy was faltering, especially the internet economy that really didn't exist. I mean, this is pre-Google. So an ad-based economy without a real scalable ad-based platform.
Yeah.
And so actually, one of my hardest lessons was my first lesson. I'm very fortunate to have experienced this now, 18 years ago. We had to file that company, PhillyTonight.com. We had to file Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Okay. We had a ton of debt on our balance sheet. We had no way to pay it back. Nobody was investing in the market. In the general.com market, I think we were one of, probably thousands of startups that went belly up at that time.
Sure.
But growing the company from, the two of us to 45 back to two, we were riding high with these commercials and billboards and, building a real service and presence, not only in Philadelphia, but around the globe. And, you know, we had to take it all the way down. So that was a humbling experience. Those aunties and uncles,
you must have learned so much more on the way down than the way up, right? Like, we all, for sure. Like, on the way up, it hides you. You don't even realize where you're effing up, you know?
For sure. Yeah. You only learn.
Hide all imperfections, right?
That's right. You only learn from your failures. Yeah. You learn the most from the, and the more spectacular your failures are, the more you learn, consciously or unconsciously, right? Because, you know, we see it now in other entrepreneurs, obviously, on the other side of the table, but it's about scar tissue and muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And your body does not allow you to make, or prevents you as best as possible to make the same mistakes. Right. And so you try to do it again, and whether you're conscious of it or not, you're going to avoid the same pitfalls, right? And so anyway, that was a completely humbling experience. You know, those aunties and uncles that gave us the $1 million, you know, at the Diwali party the next year, they were like, that kid filed for bankruptcy, you know, and, you know, it was definitely very humbling.
You know, but shouldn't it be like a badge of honor that if we just said, hey, you're going to learn so much more, if you've gone through that experience and you come out of it, shouldn't that be like, you are so much more investable now because you're not going to make those stupid mistakes again.
That's right. And once you face failure like that, you feel invincible, right? Because if you can get up from that and do it again, then you basically face the worst thing that can happen in business. Mm-hmm. One of the worst things that can happen in business, and the fact that you've overcome it makes you feel invincible, right? It's not how many times you fall down, but how many times you get up.
Right.
And that's it, you know? And I was really fortunate to that being my first business lesson, like, you know, on the streets. I say I got my MBA on the street, you know, in that way, in that fashion. We tell entrepreneurs now to fail fast. I mean, ideally not on our dime, right? Fail fast. Well,
but they should be fail fast and fail often, and then they're learning and they're progressing, and there's not big F ups, right? There's small F ups that they can learn from and keep moving on.
Yeah. That's right. Yep.
Yeah, dude, that's right. We branded all of our stuff, actually. You'll love this.
Yeah.
Real fast everywhere.
Love it. Yeah. It's amazing. You know, as a venture capitalist now, we can't exactly walk around with stickers that say fail fast. Although you can in like,
what are you kidding me? You VCs walk around with stickers that say spend fast.
Yeah. By the way, VC is still a term that gives me a little anxiety because mm-hmm. as a founder for, you know, over across 5 startups, like the term VC was never something that was embraced, and so I still don't consider myself or ourselves as VCs. We're founders first, and the capital piece of it is a very small percentage, right? We're mm-hmm. in the trenches helping folks like a co-founder, spend fast or fail fast before we invest. How about that?
Sure. So let's continue your story, man. So this, your first startup goes under.
Yeah. So it went under. You know, one interesting thing, you know, I was like, I was CS in college, but before that in high school and elementary school, I'd always be tinkering and coding and taught myself to code and all that great stuff. And actually one thing, all 5 startups, I was very proud to be like the first code to check in. And fortunately I hired people much, much better than me.
Sure.
As the companies grew, but the piece of code that we wrote at Philly Tonight that was interesting was an SMS platform. This is back in 98, 99, way before SMS was cool. Actually, this is before Interop. So in the States, at least, you couldn't even text Verizon and AT&T or Interop.
You have to do it within your carrier.
And you could text, only do it within
and texting was within the carrier. Doing it on your keypad and pushing for A, B, B, C.
Exactly. And so what we did at Ipsh, at Philly Tonight, Ipsh is the next company I'll talk about in a second, is we actually ended up like through brute force, we actually mapped out where we thought phone numbers, what carrier belonged to, owned what phone numbers. And by brute force, I mean, if you were just sending SMTP, like an email, mm-hmm. to phone number at the carrier suffix, you would actually get a mailed return because the interface was SMTP, and if it wasn't returned, it would go through. And so using that brute force, we actually created this really interesting map of like...
You got a database of actual numbers and where they would be.
We had a database. We had these scripts that were just running. These were millions of numbers that we would basically group and attribute to carriers. And actually what we then
you're like the pioneer of the spam duck cleaning.
Actually, here's a little known... Well, I'll talk about this on the next company, but we were thinking about doing something really interesting that would have definitely gotten us on magazine covers, in an infamous way, not in a famous way, but so anyway, at Philly Tonight, we ended up using this tech in an interesting way where you would just put in your phone number, not even your carrier, and select what type of music you were interested in. So hip hop, mm-hmm. You know, we would basically figure out what city you're in by your area code. This is before number portability, by the way. So mm-hmm. Most likely you were in your area code. And then we would text you using our technology that night, you know, that hip hop event in Philadelphia. And so we were doing SMS communication for events, for nightlife in Philly Tonight. So when we took that company under, I actually bought back the asset, that particular piece of code for like $1,000.
Because you still saw that and you were like, hey, there's still value here.
Like
if you could buy it on the cheap, then buy it and go and keep that IP.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so what we ended up doing then is I moved to San Francisco in 2001 and I spun that up into a new company. And it's called it's called IPSH. We call it IPSH, which is Instant Power Single Handed. We then actually rolled that tech into this new company, and we decided to sell it B2B. So mm-hmm. Philly Tonight, and actually the parent company of that was called Urban Groove, which was multiple Philly Tonights all over the world, went under, bought back the asset, and then created a company called IPSH. Now, ipsh was a sound that a record makes when you scratch it. Ipsh, ipsh, ipsh. So we bought the domain name. And then my buddy Vij, who's Vijay Chadha, who's like a ninja expert marketer, mm-hmm. You know, basically reverse engineered the acronym to Instant Power Single-Handed, like a little bit later when the company was doing well.
Yeah.
But what we did is we just then took that technology, sold it to brands, you know, and we started with folks like artists, because we're obviously in the music industry, who... Mm-hmm. Wanted to text their fans to maybe call it, dial in to 106 and Park or TRL, which is how you get your videos played on MTV or 106 and Park. And that's how you used to move mm-hmm. records back in the day. Before
if you got on Carson Daly or 106 and Park, you were huge.
Exactly. And actually there's a cover I still have around 2003. I can picture this very vividly. Hollywood Reporter. We were working with Nelly's label, and Nelly used our tech to register 100,000 of his fans. And we would send a text message seconds before 106 and Park voting started. Mm-hmm. And it'd be from Nelly. And it would say, "Yo, hey, this is Nelly. Click here to vote on my new video, Air Force Ones." And we crashed every single phone bank. And
that's
the calls
amazing.
That went... Calls that went through, they voted for 106 and Park. Guess what? The album video went to number one. Album went to number one. Track went to number one. Album went to number one. And now
it's stuck in my head.
Exactly. And so we knew we were onto something, right? And then we ended up working with bigger and bigger brands. And then ultimately, that company was acquired by Omnicom, one of the large ad holding groups, mm-hmm. in 2005. But, you know, that was my first entrepreneurial journey. It was Philly Tonight to Urban Groove, going bankrupt, buying the assets, building Ipsh, and then selling Ipsh. One thing I'll never regret is, and I think this is important for founders to understand too, is, you know, we did have angel investors in Urban Groove and Philly Tonight. We ended up giving them options in Ipsh because we didn't raise much new capital in Ipsh. And we felt like it was a continuation of the business, right?
Yeah.
Especially because we bought the assets, but listen, these guys bet on us very early. And so everybody did well ended up creating a lot of goodwill. And I think it's often entrepreneurs forget that this is a very long game, that most founders will have a bunch of could end up creating several companies in their lifetime. And mm-hmm. so they shouldn't be, you know, myopic like that. So anyway, you know, in retrospect,
it's really, that's really cool because you didn't have to do that.
No,
you didn't have to do that at all. And the fact that you took care of the people who took their first shot on you, and just brought them in, and then had an amazing outcome. I mean, they bet on you every single time.
That's right. Yeah, we created a lot of goodwill. And, you know, I was welcomed back to the Diwali parties. So that's
aunties and uncles were like, come on back in.
I'm back in the good graces with the aunties and uncles, nice. Which is the most important thing.
They'll feed you the laddus all over again. It's perfect.
Exactly. and then, you know, just kind of fast forwarding, one thing that founders are, we're unemployable, right? We work 100 hours to not work 40 hours. Mm-hmm. And so I had to get out of Omnicom as soon as I could. I lasted about 2 years. I think I had a 4-year contract. I was like, I got to get out of here. Yeah. It was great. A great experience running mobile basically for this behemoth, right? Even today, 1 out of 3 ads that you see anywhere, television, print, online, mobile, or run through an Omnicom agency. So it was very, very large. And it was a terrific experience. But, you know, had the itch that needed to scratch again. And it was actually Philly Tonight 2.0. But this time on mobile, right? What we learned through itch is that mobile marketing was just starting. And so we created a company called Buzzd, B-U-Z-Z-D, that was venture-backed in New York City. And essentially, it was a real-time city guide. So whereas Philly Tonight Urban Groove was more static, we thought the mobile device would be a great venue for input and output of real-time events. So if you were at a bar, club, restaurant, you could actually very quickly log what was happening now, pictures, text, video, mm-hmm. and anybody anywhere could consume that information. So if you wanted to know if this bar was packed or if this club
having FOMO from the place you're at and say, hey, what's going on over there? You don't got to walk over anymore. Just go jump into Buzzd and see what's happening.
Exactly. And by the way, there's still no Buzzd. Ideas for anybody who are listening.
Foursquare kind of tried it. Right?
So we then grew into this cohort of all these location-based services mm-hmm. between 2008, 2010. So Foursquare was the dominant player of the cohort, but there was Looped, there was Gowalla, there was Whirl, wow. right? There was Buzzd. Whirl was Acquihire, I think, Amazon. Looped was, I think, Blue Dot, maybe. Gowalla was Acquihire, Facebook. Foursquare obviously has pivoted since and merged, and now they're, you know, premier location-based provider of data. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Yelp, right? If you think about it today, I mean, if you were to fire up, imagine, San Francisco, Toronto, New York on your phone and get a heat map of what's happening right now and actually be able to drill into, you know, not only city blocks, but venues. The amazing thing is today, the real-time social media is, you know, a million X, right? What it used to be in 2008, because you have geotagged Instagram and you have geotagged tweets and you have geotagged, you know, Facebook posts and
everything. You got to just
everything. And TikTok and Snap.
Everything. Everything's geotagged. Yeah.
Dub smashed, whatever, right? And so a bunch of that is public, right? Yep. Majority, all of Twitter is, all of Insta is. So being able to now pull that information in, you actually don't even need a platform to create your first party data, just be an aggregator. And, you know, and see what's happening. So I think, you know, I think there, by the way, still is a use case and an interesting proposition for Buzzd. Whether there's a business model or not, that's another question. Mm-hmm. Which leads me to the story that Buzzd failed because it was very hard to monetize. You know, we actually bet big on BlackBerry in 2008. We were BlackBerry Fund's first investment. And actually Matt Golden, who was at the fund, was part of that deal team. We work very closely with him now on the venture side. He runs co-founder of Golden Ventures in Toronto. And so because of that investment, we didn't have to, but we built pretty aggressively for BlackBerry. And you know, it definitely benefited us in the beginning. We were top of the App Store. I have still screenshots where we're above Facebook even in 2008, 2009, in the BlackBerry App Store. A lot of the other LBS apps at that time, you know, iPhone just came out, were building for Apple. And we didn't build quickly enough for Apple. I mean, I think another lesson learned is startups, most scarce resource is time.
Absolutely.
And if you focus on one platform, you better do it amazing on that platform. And for us, iPhone was kind of a, you know, was a side thought, right? BlackBerry was core.
BlackBerry was what, 80-90% market share then?
It was, yeah, it was. And so obviously we rose with BlackBerry and we fell with BlackBerry, right? But, you know, through the process, met some incredible people. We actually ended up using a little known company in 2009 to build our iPhone and Android apps. That company became Extreme Labs. I remember meeting Umar and Sunny in our office. And actually Umar, I know we want to talk about Ocean's 11, ended up coming to an Ocean's 11 with our iPhone product at that time. This was, I think, 2009 or 2010, maybe. And it basically was a shot glass on your iPhone, and you use the accelerometer. Use the accelerometer to basically put it upside down or drink it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when it goes right side up, we would actually just surface to you one cool thing to do near you. So it was fun. It was curated. And that was our iPhone strategy. In any event, that business failed. You know, we burned through, I think, $4 million in venture. 2010 came around. We were not the leading location-based service provider. Foursquare was. We were forced to pivot.
Both of you too, being New York companies, right? In a time where it was just thought great startups only come out of the Valley, which is something else I admired about you guys. You, Dennis, at Foursquare, and everybody else, you guys were the first ones to band together and not be enemies, but actually start to build an ecosystem around New York City.
Yeah, I think the thesis then was, listen, there's no other city like New York in terms of density and in terms of just the social energy. And so it kind of felt natural for a city guide, a social, you know, location-based service to be in New York, right? Anyway, I know Dennis thinks very, very strongly about that, you know, as well. We were forced to pivot in 2010. And so actually taking a page from my Philly Center Urban Group to Ipsy is going B2C to B2B, kind of understanding, observing a behavior for B2C and then leveraging that for marketers in B2B, seemed like, you know, it could work. And the first go around, we understood that folks really like getting text messages, you know, 20 years ago, and that marketers could send text messages to folks on an opt-in basis. The second go around was that people also were creating all this real-time public social media. And obviously Twitter was just starting to grow at that time. Jack actually ended up, I met him at an Ocean's 11 in Barcelona in 2009. Could we leverage that social data to actually make ads more targeted, right?
Right.
And so that became the inspiration for the pivot from Buzz to a company called Local Response that was launched in 2010. We ended up raising another $10 million. That company got up to about $10 million revenues annually. And it was later acquired after a merger. You know, ad tech, the whole category got commoditized very quickly soon after that. But that was, you know, my second basically cycle, right? Startup number three, I guess, Buzz.
Yeah.
Turned into Local Response and then merged and then was acquired. So, it was an interesting time. A lot of more scar tissue developed. you know, one thing I gained from both those experiences was really selling into the Fortune 5000, because all of the B2B companies, those would be the best customers of those products. Mm-hmm. And so the interesting thing about that whole category is folks that you meet at a very high level end up staying at that level at different companies. And so your network essentially keeps growing. And that's one thing that I'm very grateful to have developed as a founder and now utilize pretty much every day as an investor, because those folks, actually some of them are even on this Instagram Live.
Yeah, they're jumping on. I'm looking and they're jumping in and out.
You know, a lot of them were my clients and customers. They've become my friends and they're still doing amazing things at different companies. So, but those are my startup chops, you know, Philly Tonight, Urban Groove, Ipsh, and then Buzz Local Response. You know, eventually that, like I mentioned, was the, both of those were acquired. So, you know, fun times. You know, being a founder, as you know, is definitely not easy. You know, but there's a reason we do it. You know, it's like the highs are so high, the lows are very low. The highs and the lows happen many times every day.
And sometimes, and you know, the funny thing is, and I've talked to you a lot about this, is sometimes where everybody thinks you're on this and you should be on this high, that might actually be your low. And then for me, it's been the vice versa. When times have been really effed up at Tribal Scale, is the times where I'm on my high because I'm like, hey, I know what I'm solving right now. You never know. You never know. Before we switch gears, I've been doing this little part where I start rapid firing questions at you. And so I'm going to rapid fire some questions at you, and just no long-winded answers. Just quickly, let's get people to know you better. Okay. I've been doing this one a lot, and it's interesting to hear what responses come back. What are you binge watching right now?
Probably my son's Power Rangers, because you know, we're all working from home. I've got two young kids. My oldest is 5 years old, and so his iPad, you know, there's no more screen time limitations. So that's probably what I'm watching the most. I'm trying to get through Ozark, but like, I just haven't been able to like sit down and just have peaceful Netflix binge. Like I can't wait to get into Ozark.
Oh, dude, Ozark is great. Do you know what helped me do it though? I watched it on airplanes, and if you're watching it, I would be watching it on my phone. Yeah. And just Ozark goes so slow sometimes. Like I don't need to see the car pull up. You get out of the car, walk into the door, just to know the guy's there waiting to shoot you or whatever. Like you hit the 10 seconds, like, let's go, let's get on with it.
Yeah, I wouldn't think it's good like plane watching material, right? You probably need something a little bit more fast paced.
So you just keep skipping through it. But you got a newborn at home, so congrats.
Yeah, Sai is going to be 4 months Saturday. So yeah, he's keeping it interesting as well. But we're so blessed and grateful to spend so much time with these little guys at this age.
Absolutely. If you were going to jump on a plane and go somewhere, where would you go?
I would go to Hawaii.
Cool. You know, I had Raj Singh on yesterday on the podcast. He said the same answer. He was like, Hawaii.
Yeah, it just feels like it's a good place to be right now. It's an island, and there's water and beaches.
I come and visit you post-corona in New York. Let's promote a small business. Where are you going to go take me to eat?
You know, it's I would take you to Momo Fukunishi, but David Chang closed it 2 weeks ago.
I think they closed all the Momo Fukus here in Toronto as well. It's
sad. I mean, it's really sad. It's really sad what's happened to restaurants. You know, part of our thing we built a couple months ago called Help Main Street, just trying to, you know, help some of these folks. But you know, I think half of these restaurants are not going to exist, you know, post. So. I don't know, man. I don't know where.
Let's give a plug to one of your favorites, and hopefully, their people are gonna support them and get takeout and do whatever they can, so they're still around.
I mean, you know, like I said, Nishi, I hope the Sushi Seki right next door to us in Chelsea is still open. I'm dying for good sushi, that's for sure. Otherwise, you know, in San Francisco, Akiko was our spot. That's still alive and well. They converted to takeout.
Cool. You know what? Let's forget the rapid fire stuff. Let's take some time. Talk about how Main Street, man.
You like rapid fire didn't work because you didn't give one word answers.
No, I didn't need, it doesn't even have to be one word answers. I think you just like started bringing me to more reality of the times of today and these unfortunate restaurants that are struggling right now. So let's talk about your initiative with Help Main Street, and we'll get back to some of the other stuff we're going to be talking about, like your fun. But Help Main Street, you saw this pandemic hit and the hall goes into action going, I got to do something. And how'd you do it? What are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, this is almost 3 months ago now. We just saw a tweet actually that Mark Cuban had put up about the best kind of way to help a restaurant right now is to buy a gift card. It's a no interest loan. And I started looking around and there wasn't one destination to aggregate all the gift cards. You know, a few weeks later, Square launched their own directory, but those are just Square powered gift cards. Mm-hmm. And gift cards are very fragmented. We didn't know anything about the market.
And most mom and pop restaurants wouldn't even know how to get onto a platform to give you a gift card.
Exactly. And so the first thing we did is we just created like a kayak of gift cards, like an aggregator of gift cards. And it's still very much in the mission. We don't take any transaction or house any transaction. We just forward it to a trusted source that the merchant already has a relationship with. So, you know, a bunch of merchants have Square gift cards or, mm-hmm. You know, other types of gift cards. And we would create a directory. We create a directory and we would just send traffic to the various pages. But it was very surprising to know that there wasn't one destination for all the gift cards. And so we started there. That took off. Sure enough, that was a niche that wasn't filled. And then we started expanding. And the interesting thing about this project is we're getting so much pull from the market, you know, from other incredible restaurateurs and other people in the industry that are saying, here's another hole, here's another hole, here's another hole. And we've just been able to grow and expand our roadmaps. And we started
awesome. So you started perfectly. That's a good lean product story, right? Like just go out there, do one thing and your users are going to tell you what else you need.
Exactly. And it was, you know, a very low impact, high value. It's like incredible ROI, right? Like mm-hmm. we pulled two all-nighters. I found actually a buddy put a bunch of us on Slack and we created a team of volunteers. We have 12 amazing, incredible volunteers, a bunch of engineers from a startup called Lunchbox. And these guys just rocking and rolling, you know, because mm-hmm. I think also during this time of anxiety, and stress, I think people need purpose, you know, and of course we're trying to you know, manage our families and our work, but I think when you're able to channel a lot of your anxiety into altruism and to helping others, it's just a win-win. You know, it gives you a sense of purpose and you're actually helping move the needle and helping somebody out there, right? And so it's been incredible to watch so many tech entrepreneurs as well, just building, spinning up very simple projects that a lot of our friends have been doing that are making big dents, you know, that are really helping. So, you know, we started with gift cards. Then we noticed that a lot of restaurants had GoFundMe pages and donate links. So we started aggregating all of those.
Cool.
And then we realized this was our most recent release a couple of weeks ago, that you know, a lot of the third-party ordering platforms like Grubhub, and you probably are seeing a lot of this negative PR, are taking a big chunk, sometimes up to 30.
We saw Uber Eats is like at 30%, and then you got Fedora,
30% take. Yeah. And by the way, that's the cost of the food, you know, for the restaurant. So like a lot of these small merchants are being destroyed by the commissions. Lo and behold, there are first party ordering platforms, you know, that don't take a commission, that take a fixed fee. And, you know, these are whatever, 20, 50, 100 bucks a month. But the point is, you're not taking 30% of your gross receipts. And so these are first party ordering links. Most restaurants are promoting these on their websites. They have to use Grubhub because they use it for distribution, but they would like people to use the first party because they get to keep 30% more. And so we're like, all right, let's aggregate all the first party order links. Mm-hmm. So now you can go to Help Main Street. We're actually live.
It's helpmainstreet.com.
Helpmainstreet.com. We're actually live in 15 countries. The bulk is obviously in the US. Over 120,000 local businesses, the majority are restaurants. You can order online directly from the restaurant. So they will not give up a 30% cut if you find the link at our site. We actually verify and authenticate every single link and every single vendor on our site to make sure they're not price gouging or have any bad behavior for the restaurants. So, we're thrilled at where it's pulled us. And again, it was so easy to create. It was literally two all-nighters. Felt like I haven't done that since.
And that's awesome. I mean, if you think about it, you don't got to boil the ocean. You can start simple. You can get massive scale right away. You obviously hit a huge pain point for this industry. And you have it up and running, and you keep iterating on that product. That's an entrepreneurial story just in itself, how quickly you get such a massive scale going on that platform.
Yeah, I mean, the best products are just so simple, and mm-hmm. they start so easy. I mean, look at Twitter. And then they just have this vicious product market pull that then propels the company, right? But it's about keeping it simple. And anyway, it's so much fun. We have like the most active Slack group at Help Main Street every day. The volunteers, I think we have over 100 people in the channel now. Tons of great ideas, tons of partnerships that we're about to announce. And we've driven hundreds of thousands of dollars for local restaurants in need. So we're really proud of that.
I like it on so many different levels. I mean, we're very fortunate in tech that we've been able to still work. Not to say that there hasn't been many layoffs and stuff like that, but we've been able to work remotely and still do our day-to-day. But B, you got to go take care of your neighbors. And they're so unfortunate, they can't even go out there to earn a living. And if they do go out there and earn a living, they're risking their lives. So yep. Awesome. Awesome initiative. Okay, let's swing back. You've done your entrepreneurial journey, and you say you want to be a founder first and put money into companies, which you kind of were already doing throughout your time as a founder, but you formalized it. So talk about putting together the fund and how that came about. I love you. When you told me you were putting the fund together, we were in Barcelona at Mobile World Congress, just eating some tapas, and you were talking about, oh yeah, I've already closed it. And you like, most people run around trying to put a fund together for a year or two. You were able to do it in months. So talk a little bit about why that happened for Nihal. What was so special about Nihal to make that happen? And two, your motivation behind what kind of entrepreneurs you're looking to fund.
Yeah. I'll tell you a couple of quick stories. One is my very first investment after I sold Ipsomnicom in 2005. Mm-hmm. There was a gentleman that was dropping out of Wharton MBA, and he wanted to create a mobile ad network. And he saw, I went to Penn, and he saw that I had just sold my company to Omnicom, and he thought that I could, potentially offer some advice. And I did. He asked me to invest in his startup. He asked kind of four or five angels, I had never done any investing up until this point. And I said, okay, like I really don't know what to expect, but here you go. A few months later, Sequoia announced the seed round, and then they announced in Series A with Excel. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, that company was acquired by Google for $800 million, and that was AdMob. Actually got to know a few folks through that journey that are still incredible friends and mentor. Actually, Rich Wong from Excel has been one of our inspirations and mentors. And Jason Spiro at AdMob is a dear friend. To this day, he's still at Google. And of course, Omar Hamouy, the founder of AdMob, mm-hmm. we're still very close to. But anyway, I got to see that journey of like what real VC can do. And yeah. what happened to that story? I mean, when Sequoia and Excel came on, all of a sudden, you know, the head of sales and the head of product and the head of tech were in a blink of an eye, they were world class. Mm-hmm. You know, Tony Nethercutt, who's running ad sales at YouTube, was all of a sudden sales. Kevin Scott ran tech. By the way, Kevin Scott is now the CTO of Microsoft.
What an awesome team, and you know, seeing them grow and come through this journey, amazing.
Yeah, it was incredible, and just watching that was inspirational, and that was very. That created a great impression in my mind of like what could be possible with the right team around the table, right. Both on the cap table and in the office. Right.
Sure.
And so anyway, you know, I continued to do some angel investing and I got this email. We're still looking for this email in probably 2009 from a few friends of mine from college, Vic and Hadley and Tim. And they were thinking about putting together a fund. Hadley had been operating mobile companies. Tim was a founder. Vic actually was at a few venture shops, Chart Ventures and RRE. And they actually pinged me to see if I could help them raise money, or they actually asked me to invest. And so I responded and I said, I'm in. Mm-hmm. And they went back and they're like, what does he mean he's in? Does that mean he's going to invest? And so they asked me to clarify. I said, no, I want to be a partner.
But that's your thing. You said the same thing to me. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do next. And you were like, I'm in.
Exactly. Those are the two best words.
That's just what you do. You pump us entrepreneurs up with two words and I'm in. I was like, shit, I actually got to go figure out a business plan now. This guy's in.
I mean, there's, you know, listen, there's, when you know, when you have, you know, right? And actually even now writing checks, like, this happens time and time again. You meet an entrepreneur and it's on. And you know that in 60 seconds of meeting somebody, oftentimes, obviously you have to do your work and all that to validate your hunch. But in any case, I said, I'm in. And, you know, the rest is history. So the four of us started ENIAC One, actually was a decade ago. So we launched that in 2010. Mm-hmm. And it was a small fund, you know. It was really a
how much was it? You guys started from very small, from what I
was. Yeah, it was 1.5 million.
Yeah, it was so, like not very small. Yeah.
So it was tiny, you know. It was our money, our friends' money, mm-hmm. But we wanted to prove to ourselves that, you know, we could build a track record. At that time, actually, all of us were still building our own startups, so we were nights and weekends on ENIAC. Mm-hmm. We actually didn't charge management fees because. You know, we were working on our own startup, mm-hmm. so we didn't feel like we could justify that. Mm-hmm. We made 32 investments, and that fund is doing great.
Name dropper.
We've had some, you know, there's some big outcomes. I mean, Airbnb's in that fund by virtue of an acquisition, but Vungle, we were seed in, that was acquired for $780 million last year. Localytics was acquired earlier this year. There's a few other incredible companies still in that fund. But, you know, obviously one learning is that these things take time. I mean, Vungle took 9 years or 7 years.
9 years, a decade, yeah.
And, you know, the best companies take a decade to germinate, right? Anyway, we were having a lot of fun, you know, building startups, especially pre-product market fit is what we like to be as an operator and a founder. And so, if we could do that over and over again with other companies, as an investor at that stage, then we thought, you know, if we could do that all day long for the rest of our lives, then we would be very happy because that's aligned with our passion. And so off we went. Fund two was bigger, 12.9 million. We ended up inviting some family offices and high net worth. Fund three was our first institutional fund. So we ended up attracting some university endowments to the fund, and we became, you know, as LPs call us, kind of the institutional class, sure. Kind of GPs. That was a $55 million fund. Fund four that we're finishing up now is a $100 million fund. And we've been continuing to grow that institutional LP base. So now we manage capital for a number of universities, pension funds, fund of funds, foundations. Mm-hmm. And it's been an incredible ride. And, you know, one thing that we've stayed true to since the beginning is the stage of company that we enter at. It's pre-product market fit. Obviously the check size has changed a lot. In fund one, we always talk about this. We debate for the same amount of time for a $25,000 check in fund one that we're doing for a $1 million check now, fund four. So check size
has the check size gone to now for fund four?
Yeah, we like to lead seed rounds. Seed rounds are $3 to $4 million. We like to be kind of no more than half of that round. So we're building a syndicate with a founder. So usually we're $1 to $1.5 million or $1 to $2 million check size. We take that responsibility very seriously. So we're usually getting a board seat and we're investor of record. What that means is, you know, we are responsible for helping the company get to the next phase, to get to the Series A. And so at the Series A, there's a Bessemer, Sequoia, Lightspeed, Excel, whoever it is, that we hand the baton off to.
Sure.
And we're usually coming off the board, if not at the A, at the B. We're, of course, doing our pro rata through the B. So there's a commitment to the founder that we are, you know, back in.
That's huge. Rounds. That you're just not there just for the first year and a half, 2 years until as a founder I get to my A. No, in the hall, you've saved tranches for further investment so that you could. You're part of the journey with the founder, as you
That's
said.
Right.
You're just not the money. You're just not dumb money in, right? Like you're doing this as a group of founders to help founders.
That's right. I mean, we feel like, and our founders tell us, we're like co-founders with them without the title and the equity, but mm-hmm. the same kind of pain quotient of being in the trenches mm-hmm. and, you know, doing whatever it takes to get the A done. So that's a lot of customer discovery, a lot of sales, a lot of biz dev, a lot of recruiting. Obviously helping even sometimes manage the fundraising process for the Series A.
Right.
But, you know, we've been doing this now for 10 years. And, you know, we said when we were creating ENIAC, you know, this is our last job and we want to be doing this for the rest of our lives. And mm-hmm. so we feel fortunate every day. I mean, to be doing what you love with whom you love is a real treat. And when you can find a job that doesn't feel like a job, you know, you want to do it all the time.
Yeah, you just want to get up and that's what you want to do.
That's what you want to do. You know, you want to help.
Even if you were on that beach in Hawaii you were talking about, I've been with you. When you pop the AirPods in or headphones in, you're like, I got a call and I want to do the call.
Is post-COVID, right? I mean, I think obviously you're reading it in the headlines. Shopify today, right? Work from mm-hmm. home forever, trying mm-hmm. to match, you know, Twitter and Square. You know, I think the future of work is very much that, you know, it's the office almost feels like an artifact.
I miss the office, the hustle, bustle, the buzz. I feed off the energy of everyone else there. But I totally get that there's going to be a time and place for it. And
yeah.
Commercial real estate models have to be flipped upside their head. There's a bunch of startup opportunities right there.
For sure. I think you and I are alike in a lot of ways, unfortunately, but we, you know, we're both extroverts. And so mm-hmm. extroverts, you know, really rely on and are powered by other people's energies. Mm-hmm. And in a time like this, you know, you can get obviously energy to a certain extent from Zoom and video, but there's nothing like, you know, the physical energy that can help manifest your own energy. And so, you know, I think that's the challenge when you're not in the office with everybody, especially when you're the leader of an incredible company like you at Tribal Scale. I mean, you know, it's hard.
It's tough. Let's talk about one of the things. I think it's Bessemer who does this. On their website, you can actually see their anti-portfolio, the stuff that's passed up on. What are some of the ones you passed up on that you're like, oh, I got it wrong. I totally missed it on that first 60-second assessment I did.
Yeah. We think about these every day. I mean, I still have the email that I teased my partner Hadley about. When we passed on Pinterest in 2010, because it wasn't mobile. I think when we started ENIAC, because we were building our companies in the mobile software space, we had that very focused lens of mobile software investment. Sure. And by the way, I think any new fund today
should
it's
do
hard
that.
To start. It's, yeah, start, it's hard to start as a generalist. You need a focus, I think, and then eventually you can become wide, open your aperture. We were mobile focused for the first two funds, and so that's why we passed on Pinterest. That was not a good decision.
I didn't even know Pinterest was not mobile first.
I'm not much of a
user of it, but yeah,
totally. And then the other one was, I mentioned we met Jack at Ocean's 11 in 2009. Mm-hmm. When he was starting this company called Squirrel, we got a demo of it. And actually my wife, Reshma, was running for US Congress actually in 2010. And we started using it, trying to use it. And Squirrel eventually became Square. And we were using V1 of the dongle. And it's definitely wasn't smooth, right?
It's also 2010.
Yeah.
2010, 2011. It's like you got Android 2.2 phones out there.
And so I actually have emails where I was introducing Jack to other VCs because I didn't think it would be a good investment. And by the way, a lot of those VCs, I still remind them that they also passed on Square. That was the first round of Square, and that was a huge mistake. So, you can't win them all. But you definitely learn from those mistakes. I think one thing I've learned, and we're still learning a lot, is that, your network is incredibly important, and, trust in that network is very important as well. And I think, if you developed a good relationship with somebody that you've known over a period of years, that, you're always betting on the jockey and not the horse. And if the thing doesn't work, the jockey's going to figure it out, if you have that level of relationship, trust, confidence with that founder. And the other thing is these businesses twist and turn and pivot a million times. You never end up with the business plan that you started with. And so, those are things that have, stuck with us, and hopefully we're making better decisions now.
For sure. For sure. One of the things I learned from you, and I didn't even realize I was doing it, but I kind of formalized myself in doing it, is learning that my network is my net worth. And that's something that, you've done a great job of building this amazing network. And you and I was loving going to your Ocean's 11 dinner. And then all of a sudden one year you can't come and you ask me to host. And I always still tell the story as if Nihal is there. And sometimes now with technology, I bring you in live while I tell the story. But tell the story of how you started this amazing Ocean's 11 dinner in Barcelona and what that's grown into.
Yeah, this was 11 mobile founders in 2001. That we decided to just get together and have dinner at that time it was CTIA, and then it turned into MWC in Barcelona. But those were essentially the wireless trade conferences, in the heyday, back when people were going to conferences like psychopaths, right?
those German infestation places.
Exactly. Back when people were shaking hands and getting badges and going to booths and going to dinners and doing deals over drinks.
And not sleeping and running in a half-made suit with your tie falling off.
Like psychopaths. Yeah. Like psychopaths. This community just kept growing. And so pretty much at every one of these conferences, we'd have a dinner. And we'd have it fully sponsored, and folks would be able to invite, people that they, that they thought, obviously it was invite only, but people that they thought would be additive to the group. And, like I mentioned, we've had Jack, we had Eric Schmidt, we've had incredible founders.
It's the one thing that everybody wants to come to. At Mobile World Congress, everybody circles it and says, "Hey, we're going to be there."
Yeah, people have said they just come in for that dinner. I can't wait to thanks for holding the torch, by the way, the past couple of years. I can't wait to go back. And by the way, you know, a good reason to hold the torch, I think it was because 1 year, my son was born this mm-hmm. year.
This year we couldn't even do it. We canceled. Oh, yeah. COVID canceled Mobile World Congress, right? We couldn't even do it.
That's right. But thanks for holding the torch, man. I'll be back there with you. But you know, I think that important that community, just building a group of folks and having a tradition around that, whether it's your family or your friends, mm-hmm. Or professional contacts, is really like the power of that is really underestimated. You know, that tradition that people look forward to and people tell jokes around and people have those vivid memories about, right? You know, I think is really important. And anyway, that's something that we built, for example, at Ocean's 11, and we're also doing that, you know, at ENIAC, you know, every day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those were good times.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. You know, it's tough to see how you're going to be able to network and create personal connections now without being able to do that. I mean, a lot of the network that I've built has been over dinners. It's been at conferences, and it's going to be tough now to try to figure out different ways of communicating. I think this podcast is a good way for us to put ourselves out there and engage with others who are going to be listening and commenting and so on and so forth. But sure. We're going to have to find different ways of doing it, at least for the short term. And that sucks. I don't know many other ways to do it, but I'm sure there's another startup idea in just being able to do that effectively.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Before we end off, I know we're going over time here, but Nihal, what's your advice to other founders, man? People want to come pitch you. What do you look for in an entrepreneur when they come to you and they come start pitching you? You say you make a decision within 60 seconds. What are you looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and by the way, just to clarify, the decision isn't made necessarily in 60 seconds.
I keep saying that because I can't wait for founders to ask you after 60 seconds in my internet.
It's you know, in any human interaction, you kind of have that first impression instinct, right?
Yeah.
And that happens almost instantaneously. And then you have to, you know, bring together a ton of data and do a lot of work to validate that or not. And anyway, you know, these days we love, you know, serial founders, mm-hmm. folks that have done it before. Like I mentioned, they fail fast before. Mm-hmm. So the next time around, cycles are compressed, you know, they're the muscle memory and scar tissue yeah. to do it much better the second time around. Ideally, it's a team that's done it before together, because you know, one thing we've noticed is one of the number one reasons these early stage startups die is just co-founder infighting. We've experienced it ourselves and through our investments.
Absolutely.
And so if you can,
and that's something I don't think it's not talked about enough. Where co-founders just rush into with each other, being like, "Oh, it's all going to work out." But people, you know, I think it's a whole other show where I think we should just talk about like what happens when chemistry goes bad.
Totally. And, yeah. and you know, that's a big startup killer. Mm-hmm. And so for us to de-risk that, we like to see founders that have done it before together. And by the way, they had tough times together. So if you had your hands around somebody else's neck, like trying to choke them mm-hmm. out in a previous experience, and you're still working with them today, that means something, you know? Yeah. And so that, you know, those are ways that we like to kind of de-risk, you know, the founding team and the chemistry around that, because that is, you know, definitely a top reason startups, early stage startups die. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, now I think we have our own interests in terms of what we like in the world. We're all engineers, so we're probably a little bit more technical than others, but there's usually some aspect of machine learning in and around the company. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, for the past couple of years, a lot of the companies we've invested in have been SaaS and have been responsible for digital transformation mm-hmm. Of usually old state industries like construction or real estate, insurance, healthcare.
Of course.
Really helping them accelerate, you know, digitally, which, by the way, post-COVID is you know, is accelerating even faster, right? Andrew Yang says 10 years of digital transformation in the past 10 weeks. And you know, that's the case. I'm sure you're seeing that.
We're seeing that. I mean, we're just seeing a massive influx of need. Unfortunately, we're also seeing CEOs listening to their CFOs figuring out how they're going to get through this tough time without spending anything. But the first place they're going to start spending is digital. And so we're definitely seeing a huge pent-up demand and the willingness to say, we got to not only digitize our processes and the way we work, but we have to become really digitally relevant to our consumers.
Yep.
Whether you're a B2B company or a B2C company, all companies.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And you were seeing that in the public markets in terms of like even NASDAQ versus Dow or, mm-hmm. you know, any, you know, yeah, Shopify versus,
as we're doing this today, the FANG exchange is at its highest it's ever been.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, and that's going to continue. I mean, maybe there's some inflation there. There'll be another adjustment. Who knows? But like the digital transformation thing is internet's been out for decades, but like now companies are forced to adapt. Mm-hmm. Otherwise they're dead. And if, taking this back to restaurants with Help Main Street, like you're seeing this, right? Like the restaurants that don't have a digital presence, like whether it's a digital gift card or even ordering online or takeout or Grubhub, they have no way to facilitate commerce. It's not even like, oh, this will supplement your revenue by 20%. It's like, no, if you don't do this, you will have zero revenue.
Yeah.
It is like the biggest forcing function. Right. And that's like an extreme case, but like there's many industries that are in that same similar boat. So anyway, yeah, that's,
and we're seeing some cool stuff. We're doing some work with a big restaurant conglomerate company. And, you know, they're looking at, hey, how could you order ahead, actually be there when it's ready for you to pick up and not have to wait around? How could they even come and do curbside drop off? So come outside and give it to you in your car. Don't even get out of your car. They're obviously contactless delivery where they can drop it at your front door. They're looking at doing all these sorts of things because they're willing to bet that, hey, this is going to take longer and they want to stay around and this is going to become now 100% of their channel because dining rooms aren't opening for a while.
And I think what's happening is that a lot of us, even say we're back to normal vaccine tomorrow, obviously that's never going to happen that quickly, but a lot of people realize there's so much dramatic convenience in what they've experienced that they can actually have a day of Zoom meetings and not have to go to the office, that they can just order from the grocery store and e-commerce without having to walk into the storefront, right? It's that that convenient, and there's no loss in quality, right, of the experience and of the final transaction. So I think that convenience is going to stick, and a lot of people, I mean, this is a big inflection point and big transformational moment in our generation. And you know, we say that some kids are like boomer babies. I mean, we have the Zoomer babies, you know what I mean?
Right.
And those are my kids. Like, certainly Sean, who's 5 years old. I mean, his school is on Zoom. He was just doing art class upstairs on Zoom, and this is what he knows, you know? And he's a ninja at Zoom, by the way. He can go gallery view, mute, leave the meeting, turn the video off. I had to get rid of Snap Camera because he was really scaring his friends. you know, it's a whole, you know, we have the internet and they have, they have digital everything. You know, we had the internet, we toyed with the internet, but they are nothing but the internet. So it's a really interesting experience.
It's funny, like we grew up with typewriters and then some computers and then internet. And then there's a generation after us that grew up with like a keyboard mobile in their hands. Yep. And then I think there's a generation after that with mobile in their hands.
Yep.
And then there's a generation that's just connected all the time and
doesn't have
to physically see each other.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. It's crazy. Crazy times. But, you know, fortunate that everybody is safe and healthy and, you know, happy that you guys are good and your teams are good. And, you know, we're going to get through it. Just, you know, just stay sane. And I've been trying to go for a little quick run every day and, you know, get on a house party with friends, you know, every so often.
Or a birthday Zoom with 100 people.
Happy birthday. Thanks for joining. That was awesome.
The hall for his birthday a couple of weeks ago. Made us all go get plastic cups where I didn't even know where I, luckily I found one. But then we all played flip cup on Zoom, but there was 100 people, only in the hall pulls 100 people for a Zoom birthday.
That was awesome.
It was a ton of fun.
Next time I'll send cups. Well, next time hopefully we'll be in person, but,
yeah,
it was chaotic, but it somehow worked out. But yeah, you know, obviously prayers up to everybody that's affected. And if there's anything that we can do, obviously help Main Street is helping local businesses, largely restaurants. But if there's any other tech projects that people think, need building, we're here to listen.
So how do people get a hold of you? How do the future entrepreneurs, the failed entrepreneurs who are ready to do it right this time, the co-founders who've been at each other's throats and are still working together, get a hold of you?
Email is the best, nahal@eniac.vc. I'll respond to almost every email. I like email because it's asynchronous. When put the kids to bed, I can just crank them out. And one thing I learned as a founder, my best experiences with investors were not necessarily the ones that invested, but they were the ones that made that one intro that was really influential and really impactful to me. And I'll still remember the 3 or 4 completely money intros that I received. None of those investors invested in my company, but they just connected the dots. And they made this intro to somebody that was dramatically impactful to my business. It changed the trajectory of my business a few times. And so that's what we try to do.
What are you interested in now also? You got, obviously mobile first was where you started 10 years ago. You talked about AI and machine learning. Yep. What else are you looking at right now that's really interesting?
Yeah, I mean, listen, the it's funny, like the more unsexy the business, the more attractive it is to us. I mean, right now I'm looking at a really interesting business that helps health insurance companies recover lost claims. So it's a multi-hundred billion dollar market
problem,
yeah. Where insurance companies are billed for the wrong things. They're either not billed, or they're billed incorrectly, or they're overbilled. And you can actually use machine learning and AI that was usually a desk job and that missed a ton of stuff. You can use ML to basically automate that process, right? So that's something that, like,
you can catch the fraudulent stuff, you can catch the missing stuff, you can catch the human error stuff. The ML is actually saying, hey, here's something human you should probably take a deeper look at.
Exactly. I think anything that's, machines are really good at anything that can automate human commoditized actions. And so that could be we have an autonomous forklift company. We have an autonomous robot, a robot arm that's reprogrammable by humans on the manufacturing line. We have obviously autonomous driving companies, autonomous naval ships. And then we have, software that automates human commoditized actions. So instead of outsourcing, to India and China, the BPO industry is now being outsourced and it's being automated. And that's the entire robotic process automation category. We have a great company in that space called Fortress IQ. So, that's the stuff that really gets us excited. But at the end of the day, it's all about the team. It's all about the founders. And if we can find an amazing founder who has had some failures in the past or some small successes in the past, and they're doing it again. And if it's an industry we've never heard of or never even had interest in, we will learn about it. We will get up to speed very quickly if the founder is that compelling. And at our stage, it's really 90% about the founder.
Awesome. Nahal, thanks very much for joining me, man. I'm gonna let you get back to Reshma and the two beautiful kids. Tell them I say hi.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to First Name Basis. This podcast is available on Apple, Spotify, LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, all social. It's there. We'll be tweeting it out also. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Take care. Hope to see you in person soon, man.